G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. It's a dangerous question for anyone who is trying to teach themselves a new skill or help their kids to learn. How exactly are humans hardwired to learn best? How do you feel most naturally drawn to learning? Does it come easily or is it hard? Are you drawn to e-readers or to physical books? Are you someone who prefers typing or handwriting? Do you like Duolingo or do you like moving to a Tuscan villa and drinking wine and arguing about Epicureanism? Look, to each their own. I'm not here to judge. I just feel like we're all kind of aware of the problem of smartphones and social media and kids and screen time. The problem may be deeper, according to today's guest. We may actually be hardwired in our brains and even in our bodies to learn in tactile, lo-fi, even Luddite ways. We're hardwired to learn in ways that technology just can't reproduce. So educational technology has been rolled out in schools all over the world at a massive pace. Tablets and Chromebooks are everywhere, and they're supposed to tailor education specifically to the child. Was the entire thing a giant scam, and is it actually causing schools to fail? Today's guest is Jared Cooney Horvath. He does education-related brain and behavioural research. He's a neuroscientist, and he's the director of the Science of Learning Group and of Neuroeducation, where he tries to take his research and apply it to the education space. He's lectured and researched at Harvard University. He's been published in The New Yorker and The Economist and The Atlantic and The New York Times and Scientific American and New Scientist. I could go on and on and on. He's got a new book. It's called The Digital Delusion: How Classroom Technology Harms Our Kids' Learning and How to Help Them Thrive Again. I don't know if that subtitle is long enough. I think you have to have at least 100 words in your subtitle of a book these days. So I loved talking to him about multitasking and rote learning and memorizing and how to learn skills that are actually transferable, especially in an age of AI and the fragility of Gen Z and how you can learn better. I hope you enjoy as much as I did. The one, the only, Jared Cooney Horvath. I'm so far away from how schools actually operate now that I didn't even realize the extent to which technology was in schools. So like for me, it's with having eight-year-olds that they're not really there yet, but how widespread is actual tech for learning as opposed to all the hoo-ha about smartphones and Instagram and TikTok and everything?
Frightening. It's funny for you're absolutely right. For all the talk of smartphones in school and getting them out, which we should, people seem to forget that, well, there's another device sitting right there in their pocket that they're going to be using quite a bit. So most of the data is going to come out of the US. So for the Australian audience, sorry about this, but you're looking at an average of at least 90 minutes a day on computers for kids. We're going K through 12 now, with over a quarter spending over 4 hours every single day on screens at school. 88% of school districts in the US are now one-to-one. That includes primary years. So we're talking about now even preschoolers are basically
one-to-one, meaning each child has a tablet.
Bingo,
or a
one kid,
or
one computer.
Wow.
Yeah. And the two first countries to hit true one-to-one status was New Zealand was number one. They bought everyone a computer. They crossed the threshold. Australia was number two. It was by 2012. You already had as many computers as students. And then it's just gone haywire from there. There are way more computers in schools now than kids. And it's weird because the more more computers there are in a country school per capita, the lower your scores become. It's like this weird seesaw that we keep investing more and more in it. But the heavier the computer side gets, the scores are just dropping along.
Is that right? And do we know that that's causal, or are there other, could there be other things going on, that the kinds of countries that are the ones that invest in tech are the kinds of countries that are fumbling education for other reasons?
That's what you'd think. So if you look at like international tests and stuff, the big dogs are always going to be Japan, China, Hong Kong, Singapore. Those are always going to be your top scores. If you look at those countries' data, those are the highest tech infrastructure countries in the world. yet the lowest percentage of kids using computers in schools. So it's one of these weird catch-22s where you would think they're high-tech countries. They are, but they don't use it in schools. So you've got a lot of this data, which is just kind of showing the tech is a driving force in this. Of course, there's going to be other forces, absolutely. Because they're, think about like the converse. The second tier level of countries that don't use tech very often are places like Mexico, Nigeria, places that don't have access to tech, and they're not scoring as high. So there's something about the infrastructure, good. The social capital, good. The actual use of it, bad. Lose both of those might be interesting. But
And just to tease that out again, is there a way of knowing whether or not it's the fact that there's technology in schools that's a problem, or could the corollary of technology in schools be that those kids are likelier to have devices at home and be distracted and be using social media and watching TikTok in their downtime, and that could be dragging their scores down even if the Chromebooks were helping them in the classroom?
These are great questions. So that's the good news is with most of these tests, with most of these exams we're talking about, they will ask questions on both of those fronts. How often do you use a computer at school? How often do you use a computer at school for homework? How often do you use a computer at school for blank? How often do you use a computer at home? How often do you use it for this, for that, for that? So they will differentiate between those two, so we can clearly say kids using computers at school for these purposes. Here's the process we're seeing. But exactly as you said, too, kids who use computers at home do worse as well. So there's going to be massive overlap. Wow. So that's where I think you can go, cool, this is, you've got to somehow move beyond correlation into causation. And how do you do that? Research. That's where now you move beyond tests and world data and you say, let's actually lock some experiments down and go. So what does the research say? Well, we've been doing that for 60 years. Tech harms learning. Anytime you bring a screen into learning, learning by and large is going to go down. It just doesn't seem to be suited to our learning. So when you've got the correlation data and you've got this kind of causative angle over here, those come together. You start to get what's called triangulation of data. That's getting us much closer to the causative argument.
And what is it that these devices are being used for that their proponents would say is useful? Like what, let's, you know, in my kids in grade 3, they're just starting to learn to type at school. Would strike me as a useful skill to have. Differ about that. But what are the so what are the things that are problematic that people are doing with tablets and computers in the classroom that advocates that think is advantageous that you don't?
Oh gosh, it's everything basically. What you just said is a very good decusation point. Is there's teaching about tech and then there's teaching through tech. If you're going to teach typing, that's a tech tool. Use it. I guess technically you could use a typewriter, but it just seems to be cool. That's the skill you're learning. Go for it. If you're learning about Excel spreadsheets, maybe the best way to do it is on Excel. Go for it. But that's very different than learning through technology. If I want to teach you math, why would I teach that through a screen? If I want to teach you writing, handwriting, why would I teach that through a screen? And that's where the kind of pendulum has swung, where I think arguments that we need to teach certain computer skills has morphed into we need to teach all skills now through a computer. And that's the biggest mistake people are making, is now computers are, they exist in every class. They interface in every way. And it's like, I'm fine if you have a computer lab and you teach typing. That's very different than having every kid have a computer and you're bringing it out during civics class. Why does it need to be there?
I see. So if you're learning about animals or you're learning about science or something, then it's not optimal to have some gamified app on a device that teaches you about, you know, mammals.
That's
or,
where you,
you know,
don't want to be touching it. Yeah,
I see.
And so what we can do is we can do moderators. So we know all up, if you just take the entirety of ed tech, it sits, this is going to probably bore your listeners to tears, but let's go with it anyway. Why not? We got to talk statistics here. So when we talk about the impact of things in the world in research, we're going to give something an effect size. That's kind of the number we use to tell you what's going on. So an effect size will usually sit between -1 and +1. -1 is as bad as something can be. Then it gets up to 0 where it's neutral, up to +1, the best something can be. Now there's caveats to all that, but that's a good window. So when we look at the entirety of ed tech, it has a positive effect size on learning of 0.29, which sounds really good. And in most fields of the world, it would be really good. But one field of research has to act differently. It is education. Because learning is biological, learning would happen even if you did nothing. If you just locked a kid in a closet for 10 years, they would still learn. So everything.
This is my strategy with my twins, by the way. I have them locked in a closet under the stairs. And I'm like, biology will take care of itself. Stop
this
scratching.
Will learn.
My beautiful,
I don't say they're going to learn a lot, tool. But they're going to learn something. So by all means, we
learn
can't
to obey
use
daddy
zero.
Is what they'll learn.
That is, so do not make this man angry. So we don't use zero in education as our standard because zero means nothing to us. So our standard in education will differ depending on who you're talking to, but realistically, it's going to sit around 0.42. So anything above 0.42.
Does that mean per annum or what?
That's how you, so technically what an effect size is it's a standard deviation shift. So we're saying 0.42 of a standard deviation growth.
And a standard deviation is what?
Is if you give me a cohort of individuals learning something, what is the average change we're seeing amongst them? And then what is the spread of that change? So if you give me 100 people and on average, they all grow 1 foot this year, you wouldn't believe that every single one of them grew exactly 1 foot. Some will have grown 2 feet. Some will have grown nothing. Some will have grown a foot and a half. So the standard deviation is basically the variance across which all these changes are happening. So where do 66% of all changes fit in? That's what we're going to call our first standard deviation, around zero. It sounds so stupid. I'm so sorry.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense. One third above and one third below. The
zero,
median.
Bingo. Okay. And then you can assume 66% of people are going to sit in that window. So that's where we kind of say, cool, if you grow one standard deviation. So if we say you have an effect size of positive one, that means you are one full standard deviation ahead of everyone else. You are now sitting in the 66th percentile. No, that's the wrong 74th percentile. My math is for crap, when everyone else would be sitting in the 50th percentile. So that's why we kind of have windows on. Technically, effect sizes can go all the way up to plus 10 and negative 10. It's just no one will ever get there. That's insane. So in education, because learning happens naturally, if you did nothing, per annum, you would expect kids to grow about 0.44 of a standard deviation. That's if you put them in any general classroom and didn't worry about anything going on or whatever's happening. We're just going to get this natural growth curve. So that's why a lot of people will hover right around 0.42 to 0.44. Some people say to 0.5. That's our natural. So if you want to say your tool is good, you have to be better than nothing. And right. Our nothing is 0.42. So now when we go back and we say...
And just to clarify, that's size, because kids go into school at the age of 5 and they leave school at the age of 18. And obviously 18-year-olds are more competent than 5-year-olds. So you have to adjust
them
for
nothing,
that obvious biological fact when you're assessing the utility of any educational tool.
Which, by the way, is pretty funny when you think that there's a school here, a system called Alpha Schools. Have you heard of those at all? So it's basically just an AI school. Kids come in, they use AI tutors, and then they go away. And their claim to fame is we 10X your learning, which I'd never heard that term
sounds
before. I guess
very
that's a business
Silicon Valley,
term.
Doesn't it? It sounds
it
like, yeah.
So we're going to 10X
it, baby.
Woo! But if you think about it, so if you could 10X somebody's learning, that means exactly as you just said, someone going into the second grade should now have the same knowledge as someone who is graduating high school. If I could make your learning 10 times faster, you should be able to cram all of K through 12 in 1 year and 2 months.
Yeah.
Does that make any... Could you imagine a six-year-old coming out with a high schooler's...
You're not going to do 10 years of education in 1 year.
And that's where you start to... So there's going to be natural growth occurring in the background that we have to account for, that you can never expect a seven-year-old to do what this is. And so we account for that by having a different effect size value. So our average is 0.42. That's where we sit. So when you hear that ed tech has an effect size of 0.29, in every field, that's great. In education, that's bad. That means you are actually doing worse than just generic nothing methods, things that kids would have done anyway without that tech.
And in countries that are more, I don't want to say Luddite, but let's say they haven't hopped onto the big tech bandwagon and they still believe in face-to-face teaching and personal relationships between teacher and student, what kind of effect size do we see?
In tech there, in those countries?
No. In non-tech environments. Like, what would a great outcome be for the increase in learning that is plausible?
We'd always say 0.42 or 0.44 is going to be the outcome you want to see at the end of every year. You want everyone to shift 0.44 of a standard deviation. That's the average. Now, to be fair, that data comes from US, Australia, UK. Outside of these three countries, I've never seen any data that looks at that. What is the average year-on-year growth?
So that's the average when a child is being taught under a good public education system. It's not the average of what the child would learn if you locked them in the basement.
No, but they would still learn something. That's another reason. So that's why we say, because a kid will learn naturally, we can't use zero. So what do we use? And we tend to hover around what's the average year-on-year growth, regardless. And so that value comes from, I think, 1960 all the way through 2000. That seems to be where they've kind of coalesced this and come up with that number to say that's
okay. Let's talk about what's going on neurologically then, and when and how people learn, because I think we've been focused a lot. Like in 2019, Jonathan Haidt came to Australia. He and I did a tour together. We would travel around, and we would have these conversations in town halls and things. It was really interesting. Yeah. Got to know him, and then he was back on the show in 2021. And so I drank the Kool-Aid quite early on, like being anti devices, anti-social media, and now obviously Australia has come up to speed on that, and we've passed a social media ban for anyone under the age of 16. There are no phones in schools in my state, which is the most populous state in the country. And I think everyone's on that page now. Like nobody is suggesting that it's great for, you know, primary schoolers or even adolescents to have social media and devices anymore. But if you, honestly, until I came across your book and your work, if someone had just sort of asked me, like, should kids have Chromebooks in schools and should they be learning, should they be familiarizing themselves with digital life? I would have been like, well, yeah, I mean, I do all of my work on a computer. Yes, my kids should learn handwriting. Sure, they should. I mean, my daughter's learning butterfly and backstroke. Like, that's because she's a kid. I never do butterfly or backstroke, but I'm glad that I learned it when I was a kid because now I kind of know what they are. And I suppose they should know handwriting for that reason. But in reality, they should just do all of their work typing because they'll end up doing that
on a computer.
Anyway, right? Why is that? What was I missing?
I think one of the biggest mistakes we make as adults is, it's called the expert blind spot, is the better we get at anything, we forget what it took to develop that skill. We just assume the skill is the skill and that's where you start. So things we're doing as adults, we assume that then must be what kids need to do to learn how to become an adult, right? Wrong. The tools, methods, techniques, and I would say by and large technology we use as experts, as adults, to make our lives easier are the absolute wrong tools and methods you need as a novice to learn how to become an expert. And so you're good at the computer. Like you said, you live your life on the computer. We're doing it right now. That's wonderful. Were you ever explicitly taught the computer in school?
Yeah.
Like, did your teacher sit you down and teach you Riverside FM? No, why not?
Well, no, because, not this. But I mean, we had a computer, and even in primary
school, lab.
We had a computer. Yes, we had a computer for the class, and we would learn how to type on it and how to open files and things like that.
That's the curriculum question. Right. But notice you're using Riverside now without ever being explicitly taught how to do it. How did that
Fortunately,
happen?
I have a very good producer who does it all for me. I would essentially be a monkey with a machine gun if I was unleashed upon the particular app that we're using to record this on. But no, I take your point. Yes, I can pick up a piece of technology and I can use it intuitively.
Yep. And so that's where our generation ever figure that stuff out? It's because a K-12 education is not a skills-based education. It is not there to teach you how to do things. It is there to teach you how to think. It's there to teach you how to address and solve problems. The idea being that now you can adapt to whatever comes your way. So we're not teaching you history because I expect you to become a historian. I'm not teaching you math because I expect you to be a mathematician. We're teaching you these things as conduits. They are vehicles to help you think through knowledge to learn the processes by which we maneuver and adapt in this world. Now, when you get out of K through 12, congratulations, welcome to the real world, you can solve problems. Now, when a new technology comes your way, you can go, I was never trained on this. Doesn't matter. I know how to think. And that's one of the biggest problems coming out of graduates now is someone just did, well, two groups did two big surveys with hiring managers across the U.S., asked them about new hires and all this stuff. One of the biggest complaints they all have is, unless you explicitly tell these kids exactly what to do, Gen Z new graduates going into the workforce, they don't know what to do. They can't solve problems. They can't adapt easily because we've locked down their thinking so hard in a skills-based thing. You taught me this. Now you're asking me to do this. I don't know how to do that. You have to teach me that. No, we've always been so good at using K through 12 to teach you how to think. And now with tech, we're teaching you what to do. And that's a very different proposition when it comes to schooling. So I would say the if we teach them the tools, don't be surprised when you don't see any of that ability off of the tool. But if you teach them how to think and learn, get ready. No one taught me how to type. I can type just fine. I'm not an idiot because you taught me how to figure things out. That's what we're kind of gunning for in a K through 12.
That it's interesting that you mentioned the, you know, the complaints that hiring managers have about Gen Z or Gen Z. And it's yeah. something that, you know, I feel as I enter middle age and work with younger staffers as well. Not now because I'm independent and I get to choose them. But when I was working for, you know, big media organizations and had to work with the people who I was assigned with, I always ascribed the issues that I had with that generation as being a sociological one that was more of a, you know, the coddling of the American mind and like yeah. Greg Lukianoff's work and Jonathan Haidt's work and the sense of, yeah. I suppose, self-entitlement and self-victimization that perhaps mm-hmm. A particular generation has that is not as maybe jaded as me and my older millennials or Gen Xers are, where it was like we hadn't taught resilience, we had taught vulnerability, and we taught them to elevate what we would previously have regarded as fairly petty concerns as being like very, very damaging to them, and that the sun shone out of their ass. And those were that was the context in which I was understanding the rift between older workers and younger workers. How much what is your hunch about the extent to which it's a sociological thing and the extent to which they literally don't have the cognitive capacity to work in an innovative and hardworking way?
Believe it or not, the coddling of the American mind argument is the exact same argument. It's just instead of using teaching typing, it's we're teaching them resilience. Is once we started, so why is Gen Z, I'm sorry for Gen Z listeners. We're just saying
because there are a lot of good ones. There are a lot of good ones. There are standard deviations. 66.67%.
You're better. That's it. We're just saying on average, why are things shifting? Is so Gen Z is considerably less resilient than millennials and Gen X, despite the fact that they have spent over 400% more of their school time being taught about well-being, resilience, mental health. Why? If I devote all this time to teaching you about something, why can't you do it out here? And that's the transfer problem. When you teach a skill, that skill will become locked to the context within which you teach it. And unless you explicitly help me learn how to transfer it, move it into new context, it will forever be stuck here. So in a very real sense, when we teach kids about resilience, that is very different than teaching them in a way that forces them to be resilient. When I teach you about being happy, that's very different than teaching you in a context which allows you to be happy. Probably the best way to kind of think about it is, Goodwill Hunting, when the dude was like, you could tell me everything about the Sistine Chapel, but you never stood in it and smelled it and looked up at that ceiling. So you really don't understand anything. Mm. That's the problem. As K through 12 education has kind of shifted into this model of, we're going to teach you skills, skills for work, skills for tech, skills for life. Cool. You get into life. You don't have any of those things. You can, so long as you put me on my computer, I can show you what I can do. But if you ask me to do the same thing over here, I can't anymore because I locked my skills down to what you taught me. So instead of teaching generally, you taught so specifically that nothing really moves outside of that. So believe it or not, it's the same argument. It's just
I think there is a wrinkle in the argument that you're missing, which is also that we were teaching, not just that we were only teaching them facts about resilience rather than putting them in situations that actually fostered resilience itself, but also that we were teaching them the wrong facts about resilience. That there was a
probably
there was a shift from suck it up, life is hard, you've got it pretty good, to you live in a society that is inherently unjust, where you are being oppressed, and the best thing to do is to pick at all of the scabs that you feel and to resent the people who have wronged you and to resent the man. So there may be, but wade into that.
Using the daylights out of you. I was talking about this with someone earlier today. So I live in Portland, Oregon, if for those who are listening, which is probably the best example of that.
Yes, right. There's a whole show, Portlandia, about that phenomenon.
Which you watch the show and you think, that's funny. And then you move here and you go, that was a documentary. That was pretty much, they overdid it in some skits, but not by much. But so it's one of the more interesting things about that phenomenon is it shifts your identity into things you hate. And I'm very clear on what everyone in Portland hates. I know what they don't like. I know what they don't want to be happening. I know what isn't good for them. The one thing I've never been clear on is, what the hell do you like? And when it comes to personal identity,
drizzle, I would say.
I like mist in the air.
If they haven't left, then they love drizzle and low-hanging gray cloud.
Mediocre cold. Okay, gotcha. But there's a difference in a negative identity versus a positive identity. And I feel like that when we kind of focus on the victimhood and very much focus on the negative, and they're very clear on what they don't want to happen in the world, but they've never planted their flag inside themselves as to, wait a second, who am I? What do I actually like? What am I fighting for? What do I want to build? And in my estimation, that is a stronger identity. And so if you've never built that aspect of yourself, you're kind of waffly. And you're right, that will absolutely translate into the workforce, where now you've got younger kids and you're like, why can't you do, I figure it out. Dude, I don't got to hold your hand for everything, but we kind of do at this stage.
It's also harder to do. I mean, it's harder to figure out what you want to do and what to do to get it and how to be constructive and how to build than it is to, it's quite nice to wallow in your complaints. It's easy. It's an easy way to construct an identity. I mean, it's funny you say that. I'm just remembering a friend of mine works at a major tourist, piece of tourist infrastructure in Australia that I won't mention. And they had a promo where an American football company for the what's the big sports event that you guys just had? You call it the Super Bowl. That's right. Not the World not the World Series of baseball.
The World Series is baseball.
World Series between only American teams and the Super Bowl. But so for the Super Bowl,
there are two Canadian teams. That's why it's World. We opened our border to there.
Right. That's amazing. Very magnanimous and worldly and pluralistic of you. So there was this American team mascot to celebrate the Super Bowl, who came to this tourist place and was doing all these funny things and sort of grabbing people and hugging them as they went on the rides and high-fiving people and everything. And my friend who works in HR at the place just had a terrible day the following day, because there were so many complaints. Like, everyone over the age of 28 thought it was hilarious, and half the people under the age of 28 were coming with complaints that they didn't appreciate being physically touched, and they hadn't provided their consent over being hugged by a mascot. So there is yes, they've obviously learned that there's a way of being in the world that rewards or encourages that behavior. On the unrelated question, I think, which is the deeper one that you were pointing to, which is, there's a difference between learning facts and actually embedding them in yourself as a way of living through experiencing them, the Goodwill Hunting anecdote. It reminds me of, there's a thought experiment that you do in Epistemology 101 in philosophy about Mary's room. Have you heard of Mary's room? Mary is a...
Mary
is a...
more.
Is a... a character in this thought experiment who is raised from the age of, you know, since she was born in a black and white room where she doesn't have the ability to either see herself or to see any colors. I'm not quite sure why she can't see herself. Maybe she has like one of those dog, you know, the things that sick dogs wear where there's like a cone around their head. So she
couldn't see the black and white either.
She's somehow never seen, I never quite understood. It's like all these philosophical thought experiments always fall apart, like the trolley problem and stuff. You're like, why is it going to kill? Is it definitely going to kill the man?
Is someone driving it?
I can't picture this trolley. Anyway, so Mary's for some reason has never seen a color. But she's read up all of this information about the wavelength of light and what colors are called, and she knows everything. She knows more about colors than any human being alive. She's like the world's leading color expert. She knows all of the shades and all of the wavelengths and everything. But she's never seen one. And one day they open the door and she walks out into a field and she sees butterflies and she sees the blue sky and she sees, you know, flowers. To people who think that data is what makes your mind, there should be no difference because she can identify all of those colors and she knows them all perfectly. But obviously she's going to be overwhelmed by the extraordinary inputs that she's seeing. And that difference between the information, like there is, what's interesting for the philosopher is there's, for the, especially in epistemology, which is about how we know what we know, what's the extra thing that she's getting? She's not getting anything. What? There's nothing that you can point to that is the extra thing that she has in that scenario that she didn't have when she was reading the books. So that is the thing that people call qualia, or the experience of being alive, the experience of experiencing something in addition to the knowing of the thing. And you're just sort of reminding
the knowing of
that.
Yeah. And it was, I hate to tangent here, but I'm going on it. This is where philosophy and neuroscience started to collide. And we started to go, oh, you guys were quite right. Long story short, I could tell you a story now. I'm going to tell you in 2 seconds here. The color blue doesn't appear in any piece of ancient Greek writing. In the Odyssey, in the Iliad, and any of Homer's contemporaries, blue just never appears. So there was always this big debate on, did they see blue or did they just not have a word for it? How are they describing it? What's going on there? Cut to today, we now get to interact with tribes all around the world who haven't, one of them is in far north Queensland. One is over in Africa. They're called the Himba. And we know their languages, so we can start to test these things. Himba is one of the few tribes that do not have a word for the color blue. So now we can actually test the qualia concept and say, okay, the word doesn't exist. The concept doesn't exist. If you show them a green square and a blue square and you say, which one of these is different, or like 10 green squares and one blue square, they won't see the difference. They'll say they're all green. And so they're somehow, their brain is shifting their perceptions into their stories for how they think the world should be. If I was never taught A and now I'm shown A, my brain will change the input so that A either doesn't exist or squishes into how I think A should have been, off I go. So this is where we're starting to find the neuroscientific feedback mechanisms. We call it top-down processing here. Some people call it bottom-up, depending on what field you're in, fine. Where, by and large, we do not live in this world. We live in our head. But our head is filled only with facts, but those facts have to be then met with experiences as well. If exactly as you said, if I knew the color blue but never saw it, as soon as you showed me blue, I would have no clue it exists. If I saw the color blue but didn't know it was a concept, I also would not see the color blue. I would just see gray or something else. So you've got this sweet interplay between I need knowledge and I need experiences to come together to help me drive my own perception.
Amazing.
And I think we're really good at giving people, teaching them concepts like resilience and the ideas of well-being, but we bubble wrapped them so hard that they've never had to actually experience it, so it goes nowhere in the system.
Well, the fact that cultures didn't have a word for blue makes me feel good about the fact that I only seem to know about 6 colors. And when people say, oh, look at that teal dress, I'm like, I'm sorry, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Go with that one.
But that is, maybe
there's a tribe up in Queensland. Oh no, they were in the Northern Territory. Excuse me. That was interesting as heck. So their language is based only on spatial, on the cardinal points, northeast, southwest. They never have any self-referential language.
Oh, wow.
So like, whereas you and I would say, ooh, that bee is close to my toe, they would say that bee is north, northeast of my toe, or whatever the heck it happens to be. They don't use themselves as a reference point. So some researchers ran a really cool experiment with them where they showed them a table with a bunch of objects on it and said, memorize the position of these objects. They took the objects away. They turned the table around so their body would shift. And they'd say, now replace those objects. And you and I, with self-referential, we just put them exactly how we saw them the first time. They would always invert them. Or if they move the table sideways, they'd put them sideways across the table. And they say, why are you doing that? They go, because it aligned northeast, southwest. They'd never use themselves as a reference point in their language. And so when you realize that that's basically a memory game, can you remember how these things sat here? They were changing their memory to their story of the world. So not only is this changing our perception, it also shifts our memories of what has happened in the past. So
they probably didn't even feel like they were changing their memory. They probably just thought, of course they point that way because they're pointing, you know, southwest, same way that they were the last time I saw it.
Maybe we changed our map. Who's to say? I mean, that's where you start to see. I don't know where the truth is going to lie. Are they right? Are we right? Are they wrong? Who knows?
Yeah.
But I wouldn't notice. I wouldn't think I changed my memory. I would just be doing exactly how you told me to do.
Yeah. It's interesting. I wonder, when you said that the ancient Greeks didn't have a word for blue, if you've been to the Greek islands, there's a lot of blue. Right. The sea is very blue and the sky is very blue. And I wondered whether it was one of those things where it's almost like the fish that doesn't know what water is. Like, you almost don't need a name for the thing that's everywhere.
Like, you're so surrounded by it.
Sort of. Maybe colors are things that differ from the norm. And if neutral is blue, then maybe you don't need a word for neutral. It's just the zero. It's like the color zero.
So Homer used to call in most of the Greek lit, the sky was white and the sea was gray. Those are the two colors they picked for those two objects. And our argument would be, once we met the Himba, we would ask, what color is the sky? They would say white. And now that we knew they couldn't actually pick out blue, we assume maybe they just see the sky as white. And so
the Himba has been reading a lot of Homer. Which is really
strange. That's just, why did they get there? But it's funny. So the paint they use, that comes much later. But you're right. The one of the researchers who does this work, he said, I don't think the Côte d'Azur was ever not azure. It's just somehow that was not an important feature for them. So they never really keyed into it. They were more into brightness, I guess.
So just coming back to education then, this idea that creativity sort of emerges from the practice of learning how to learn things rather than rote learning does bump up against what I thought like we had absorbed over the past few decades about East Asian cultures and like tiger moms and the success of like the Chinese education system and even the success of like Asian migrant communities in Western countries like Australia, where there seems to be an enormous amount of rote learning and perhaps
rote is
a
not
lack
bad.
Of creative. Okay, rote is not bad.
No. So rote is definitely not a bad. We're not saying you shouldn't learn stuff. So if you go to creativity, what is creativity? Creativity is nothing more nor less than the mixing and matching of your current memories to an unknown problem set. How do I represent my angst using this guitar? How do I clean up trash from the ocean? Here's all the things I know. How can I rearrange them to fit this to solve that problem? So facts become the stock in trade by which creativity occurs. The more information you know, the more creative you will be 100% of the time. And the important aspect of this is it's the amount of information you have embedded within you. You have rote memorized or at least locked down. It's not the amount of information you have access to. So a lot of people made the argument that tech means you don't have to learn stuff anymore. You can just jump right into creativity because you can look anything up. Most of creativity and critical thinking and what we would call these higher order skills, most of the heavy lifting happens when you stop paying attention. It's subconscious. So believe it or not, when it comes to creativity, what you'll do is, let's say you want to tackle a problem. You're going to get to work on that problem. I'm going to start strumming my guitar. After a couple hours, you're going to get exhausted. You're going to be like, this isn't working. I'm not doing the right song. I'm out of here. You're going to go cook dinner, take the dog for a walk. When you leave, that's when your brain gets to work. Now, what your brain is going to do completely subconsciously without any input from you, it's going to take all those things you were just consciously doing, and it's going to try and find matches in your memory that you never even realized you had. It's going to say, remember in fourth grade you did that? That's kind of like what you're trying to say here. Remember that time you petted that dog? That kind of felt like what you want to do here. And it's going to come up with its own combinations. And every once in a while, your brain, with no input from you, is going to say, I found a match. And you're going to get what's called a moment of insight. So you're going to be washing the dishes, and all of a sudden you're going to go, oh, I got an idea for that song. Give me the guitar. Let's go. So you go through these periods of focused thinking, diffuse thinking, focused thinking, diffuse thinking. When you're in focused mode, by all means, you can access the internet and look things up. But as soon as you enter diffuse thinking mode, which is probably more important than the focus part, your brain can't access the internet. So it is stuck only with those things you know. That's why memorization is still absolutely key.
So let me just push back quickly on this idea that creativity is dependent on knowledge or facts. So there are many instances of creative geniuses who dropped out of school and went into their garages and either formed a Nirvana or some other great band, or they did a Bill Gates and invented personal computers, or whatever it might be. And there are lots of cultures where nobody does rote learning and nobody learns facts and memorizes things, but they produce great music, they produce great art. Why doesn't that disprove your correlation?
So if you're thinking about facts in terms of names and dates, which is absolutely an aspect of facts, but think about music. A fact for music is, how do you hold the guitar? How do I push this finger down? How do I move my strumming hand? There's a lot of different facts that aren't just memorize this bit of information. So you'll find a lot of, you're absolutely right, you'll find a lot of geniuses that didn't go to school. What you will never find anywhere in the world is a genius who hasn't spent at least 8 to 12 years doing nothing but drilling, training, and practicing and locking down their skills. That's that fact kind of part. So go back to Nirvana. My favorite, this is one of my favorite stories, was Dave Grohl, drummer for Nirvana, leaves Nirvana, makes a Foo Fighters, picks up a guitar. He's like, I never played a guitar before, so I just played it like I play a drum. And so that's how I came up with the song, the strum for this song. At which point his mother comes out and says, you had a guitar when you were 7. Here's a picture of you playing a guitar when you were 7. You have always been playing the guitar. You weren't paying attention, but it was always there. And you were always drilling it and practicing musically. And there's no magic to the system. It's all work. So believe it or not, I'm working on a documentary right now on genius. So that's why I'm all over that field as well. But what might not seem like facts to us is to them. Picasso starts studying oil painting at age 7, doesn't produce his first original, what we'd call Picasso work, till he was 18 years old. That's how much just drill, lock it in, get it down there is. So there's a lot of practice there. The shift that I think we were talking about before is, it's not learning stuff is bad and learning how to think is good. Those two are going to go hand to hand. If while I'm teaching you stuff, I'm also teaching you how to think, that's when we're getting the bang for our buck when it comes to education.
Right.
But if I avoid teaching you stuff and I avoid teaching you how to think because I'm teaching you a skill that requires you to do basically neither of these things, just produce work. Can you make a PowerPoint on the Civil War? Well, yeah, I don't have to learn anything about the Civil War to do that. And I don't have to learn anything other than, how do I open PowerPoint? Sweet. It just narrows everything so dang much that you're left with really non-transferable skills as you start to get older.
What if you need to make the PowerPoint about the Civil War without being connected to the internet?
Now we can have ourselves a good time.
What is it about the technology? Because presumably the proponents of education technology would agree, well, they may not, but the person like me who was just an idiot about this might say, yeah, of course you need to learn stuff. We don't want people just be Googling everything and just be using AI for everything. You've got to learn the stuff. But maybe the best
way to learn
stuff.
You think that's what they're not trying to do?
Maybe the kids are trying to do that. But what I would say is, if my son thinks that he learns more about snake reproduction and the way that black holes are formed by watching videos on a device about that than by learning it from a teacher or in a book, what is the impediment? What am I missing there?
So now here's where we can start to really then get into mechanisms. Impediment number one is going to be your attention impediment. Attention is everything when it comes to learning a memory. Where you set your attention, that's where you learn. How you sustain that attention, that's how you learn. When I am learning from, say, a book or a person or a textbook or, I don't know, a wall hanging, there's very little I can do besides that or nothing. If I have a book, I can either read it or not read it. There's not much more I can do. As soon as I shift that onto a device which allows me to access anything I want in the world, you can imagine I'm now being pulled in myriad directions. And yeah, I might really like this video of a snake, but I'm just going to hit pause real quick and check my mails. Oh, and here's another video that's on the feed. Maybe let's jump to that real fast. When you start this jumping, we call that multitasking. That is hands down the worst thing you can do for learning and memory. I don't even pull that punch. As soon as you start multitasking, you go slower, your accuracy drops, and your memory tanks significantly. But your confidence goes way up. What you think you just learned goes through the roof. You're like, I just nailed it. I can do that. I'm good. So impediment number one is the tool itself is designed to be a parallel processor. The reason a computer is a computer is because it can do 15 things at once. Humans are not parallel processors. We are serial. We can only do one thing at a time. But anytime I use this device, I will start to think like it and I will start to use it to its capabilities. So believe it or not, watching a video about a snake is not a problem. Watching it on a screen, cool. Watching it on a computer, you are more apt to learn from the TV screen than the computer simply because there was nothing else you could do but watch it from the screen. So the attention and the idea that tech exists to do many things at once, that already makes it an impediment to learning, where I can't have you doing 10 things at once. I only need you doing one thing at once. But take it to the next level now. Okay, so let's say I have a kid and he's just doing snake video, but nothing else is closed. It's a locked system. Now we're doing learning, right? Not so fast. The next level of learning, or a key driver of the next level of learning, is what's called empathy. Empathy, what is it? A lot of people think they have empathy, like it's an emotion, like I'm an empathetic person. You don't have empathy. No one does. I don't, you don't, nobody's got it. Empathy is not an emotion. It is not a personal thing. Empathy is a transpersonal emergent property. So it sounds scary, but it's simple. Think about magnets. You got a north magnet, you got a south magnet. Where is your magnetic field? Nowhere. It doesn't exist in either of these. But when you bring them together, a magnetic field emerges as a new property. It's not in either of the poles. It is of their interaction. Empathy is the same way. When two human beings begin to interact, their biologies will start to synchronize. Their hearts will start to beat at the same time. They will start to breathe simultaneously. They will blink at the same moments. If I could image their brains start to look the same. That is empathy. Believe it or not, we can measure empathy. It is synchrony between two pairs or more of biology. I'm watching my snake video. There is no way in heck I can develop empathy, because there's nothing going on. There's no other set of biology. It's just me and a screen. I can empathize with another human being. If a teacher is telling me or showing me about a snake, I can start to resonate. And in that moment, I am very much thinking like my teacher. I'm no longer learning from her. I'm thinking like her. Why does that matter? Go back to our effect sizes. An empathetic relationship between a teacher and a student has an effect size on learning of 0.68, which is one of the higher things we've ever found. Which means we are biologically built to learn from other human beings. We are not built to learn from screens. We're not built to learn from, believe it or not, even reading stuff. We're built to learn from each other. And once we use that mechanism, learning becomes so much easier. Screens eliminate that entire learning mechanism.
G'day, humans. Well, if you've listened to this much of the episode, then you must enjoy it, presumably, unless you're just listening for masochistic reasons. So you should listen to the rest of it. And the way you do that is by subscribing to the premium feed, where you not only get to hear the rest of this delightful conversation, and trust me, oh, it gets better than what you just heard, but you also get to hear no ads, zero ads. And previously, up until now, you had to go to the old Substack to do that and follow me on Substack and add one more platform to your life if you're not already on Substack. But here's the thing. We are now on Apple Premium Podcast as well. So with one click, Apple will just subscribe you up to the premium feed. You'll be able to listen to the rest of this conversation right now, right now, right now. So open up your Apple Podcasts, click the old Pay Old Zepsy button. That's probably what it's called, Pay Old Zepsy. And you click the button and then you no longer have to be a free rider. You can feel like you're contributing to the mission of this show, which is really what we're all here for. Better conversations, a freer, more freewheeling attitude towards the things that we can talk about, a way to steelman our opponents and to take the most gracious approach towards disagreement. That is what you're voting for when you vote for Uncomfortable Conversations by going into your Apple Podcasts and clicking subscribe. I love you. If you don't do that, that's fine. I'll see you the next free episode, I guess. Take care.